Hello, my fellow climate warriors. This is Matt Myers, and welcome to another episode of Climate Tech Cocktails, where we grab a drink or two with best-in-class climate tech founders to learn from their life journeys, dive into bleeding-edge technologies, and have a laugh while we're at it. My guest today is Steve Bennett, co-founder and chief climate officer of the Demex Group, which is the first company to offer comprehensive solutions for modeling, assessing, and transferring climate-linked risks at scale. Steve is a weatherman turned entrepreneur whose 25-year career includes working for the Weather Channel and the Scripps Institute of Oceanography, as well as founding Earth Risk Technologies. Steve's mission is to bridge the gap between climate volatility and business operations. Steve is also a human companion for Demex's Dog Pound in Raleigh, North Carolina. Without further ado, enjoy the show. Steve Bennett, welcome to the show.
Thanks for the invitation.
So what are we drinking this evening?
It looks like you've got a bottle of wine in your hand. What have you got there?
I do. So we have a decent wine collection. As you know, we live in San Francisco, so we're fortunate enough to, you know, go up to Sonoma or Napa or blah, blah, blah. And so I'm only allowed to take certain wines from our collection to drink, right? Like the others just sit there because they're so good. And so I was allowed to take this one because it was a gift. So it could be good. It could be not so good. I don't want to insult any winemaker out there. But it looks nice. It's called Seafall, and it's a Chardonnay. I don't normally drink Chardonnay, but okay. It is a Chardonnay. And it's a Sonoma wine, 2017.
So Chardonnay for a Monday, that seems about right. The day that we're recording, day of the week that we're recording this, right?
Is that how you make decisions on what wine you're going to drink?
Yeah, Monday's a good day for a Chardonnay. Now, I've gone straight to the cocktail since the name of the show is cocktails.
Oh, right? Wonderful. What are you drinking?
I am drinking a Midnight Manhattan.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. Jeez. Well, I'm not even that much of a wine guy. I don't mind wine, but you said you're a wine guy.
Well, the funny thing is I am a wine guy. So you're telling me the story of, you know, being in the Bay Area and driving up to Sonoma on a Saturday afternoon. And I lived in the Bay Area before I moved back east. So moved to North Carolina about 2 years ago and lived in the Bay Area before that. And I love the Bay Area. Great place to live. I don't really miss the Bay Area, but I really do miss the day trips to Napa. I really do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into that just for a second. Why don't you miss the Bay Area?
I just think there are more comfortable places to live. Like, you know, you can definitely do better from a cost of living standpoint elsewhere, I think. I really liked, we lived in San Francisco in the city for several years, then moved out into the East Bay. And both were great at the time. It's just, you know, as you move through life, different things become important, and moved east to get a little bit more space, actually a lot more space, you know, lots of outdoor space, although it's not quite as nice as much of the year as it is there.
Mm. No, this isn't bad. It's not bad.
Not bad. We have a wine rating scale at my house, which runs from -2 to 2. A -2, literally, you can't keep it in your mouth. You're spitting it out. You just can't take it. A -1, don't really like it. Definitely wouldn't order it again, but you know, maybe you'll finish the glass. A 0 is, yeah, you know, not bad, not great. Not gonna send it back. A 1 is good. It's a good wine. Wouldn't necessarily go looking for it, but it's good. A 2 is absolutely love it. Would try to find it on a menu, would seek it out at the winery. And then we've added a 3 to the scale for gotta buy a case today.
Okay. Yeah. Well, this is definitely not a 3. I'd say it's a -0.5 because I don't mind it. Like I wouldn't order it again, but I want to keep drinking it because obviously we're doing this show. I guess that's a -0.5.
Sounds good. Yeah. Very good.
Actually went to wine tasting. I think it was not this weekend, but the weekend before, and it was some castle literally. Like, this guy spent 10 years and who knows how much money to build this replica of a castle in Italy.
Were there animals as well, like goats and chickens? And
oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I've been there. I can't remember the name of it now, but that I've been there.
It's called, please forgive me, Castello di Amarosa.
Okay. Is
the name of the place. And the wine, meh, unfortunately.
Oh, hopefully nobody from there listening to this. Or maybe they'll try to convince you, right? They got to send you the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they make more than enough money just because it's almost like a tourist attraction. Like,
yeah, yeah, that was why we went. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, you could take two people who have lived in the Bay Area for a while and talk about wine for hours, but we're not going to do that. Although we do all encourage people to come here on a hydrogen fuel plane or an electric vehicle and to drive up in an EV to wine country and go try out some of the more sustainably managed.
Well, and I mean, you know that climate is a huge factor for winemaking, and
yeah,
you know, the wine industry as a whole is very focused on climate and on how wine regions are changing with time. And mm-hmm. Of course, you know, the whole sustainable farming practices and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of climate in wine.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are you living now?
So I live in Raleigh, North Carolina now.
Great. I bring that up because I'm coming to Raleigh.
Oh.
Yeah. Once on a personal trip, and then late September, we're going to do a massive happy hour with Duke University, their energy center. So I'm going to do a live podcast episode. Then we're going to have a happy hour and a startup showcase.
Oh, nice. Nice. Yeah. Right. Let me know what it is. I'll be there.
Absolutely. It's going to be, I think it's September 30th, I believe is the date. And okay. Yeah, I guess it's not a spoiler alert because this probably won't be released by then, but the president of the university is supposed to make some announcement of a new climate initiative.
Oh, nice. Nice.
And it's during homecoming for the university, so it's going to be a big deal. I've never really been to North Carolina before, yet I am going there twice within a month.
And you said the other is a personal trip. Is that like a vacation of some sort? Are you coming to the mountains, to the coast, or are you just coming to Raleigh?
My partner founded a nonprofit there during her undergrad. She's a Tar Heel. And it's having its 20th anniversary. So I'm going there for that with her for that celebration. And then we're going to take a few days and go into the mountains.
Awesome.
Yeah. And Asheville.
Awesome. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Out in the western part of the state. Is the event here in Raleigh and then you're going out west or?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But good thing I'll release this afterwards so that I don't have any stalkers that follow me around.
You have a lot of stalkers, Matt?
No, not yet. Not yet. But
that's the goal, right?
Yeah. Well, that's when you know you've really made it. I do have some people that'll follow me around, but no stalkers. I guess a stalker is somebody I'd be afraid of.
Yeah, true. That has a negative, negative connotation to it. Yeah.
Totally. So before we diverge too far, let's talk about weather. I'm so excited to talk about weather. And I love how you have the Weather Channel. Is that the Weather Channel on behind you?
It is indeed.
Yeah. Well, are they constantly showing images of catastrophic weather events, or is this just a loop you have on?
No, they're actually, so today there are catastrophic events going on. So that's actually, those are real pictures. This is the event, and there's a pretty significant flood event happening in the Dallas area today. Yeah, they got 9 inches of rain in less than a day. Huh? So that's a bad thing.
That's where I'm from.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I guess I should check in with my family.
Yeah, you may want to check in. You might want to check in.
Wow. Go figure. I'm like, oh, do you have this on a loop of catastrophic weather? But these days, we can pretty much just leave on the Weather Channel and you're going to have catastrophic weather.
I saw a stat earlier today that said there's a $1 billion weather disaster like every 17 days or something like that.
Really?
That sounded a little hard to believe, but certainly there have been a number of events this year. So it could be.
I saw you wrote an article about how Yellowstone was a $1 billion weather event.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. The infrastructure damage out there, and it's going to be it's going to take multi-years to repair out there as well from the event earlier this year.
Right. So is that how we're measuring weather events now? It's on the $1 billion scale, or, and then at a certain point we'll get to the $10 billion weather events?
Yeah, it's, when we think about weather events, it's helpful to put them in context. And NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, started the $1 billion weather research program, disaster research program, within the last, I don't know, it's probably been more than 5 years, but maybe less than 10. And they're creating a very nice database that allows us in the community to be able to basically benchmark events. And that becomes important for, I mean, it becomes important just generally, so the general economics of the weather events, but especially for industries like insurance, where a big part of what they're doing is trying to help communities recover financially following significant weather events. So if you think about your home insurance or your renter's insurance or your car insurance, you know, that's the reason you have that. And weather is a big driver of loss, especially for property. So yeah.
Absolutely. If you even think about wine country, which we were just talking about, some terrible fires up there over the past years. And what are they doing? They're just getting reinsured and rebuilding in the same spot.
Yeah.
And the next fire, unfortunately, will likely hit over the coming years. And it gets to a point where you continue to rinse and repeat until you can't repeat.
Yeah. It's, I mean, that's a fascinating topic because it hits so many different, there's so many different areas that are associated with that, just that little anecdote you laid out there. So if you think about that, okay, so fires are becoming more prominent, you know, in and around wine country in California and just in the West in general, fires are a hazard that are increasing in frequency. So first there's the natural hazard, right? Then there's the fact that something's destroyed or damaged because of a fire. Mm-hmm. Insurance comes in to rebuild. So you rebuild and then another fire comes, right? And then you rebuild and hopefully another fire doesn't come. But the key here is that the insurance marketplace, insurance companies, I mean, they're good in that they help you recover financially following one of these events. But one of the really challenging things about all of this is that theoretically, an insurance company would stop insuring an area that was, you know, that was going to see repeated events, right? Because they wouldn't, essentially, it doesn't become economic to continue to pay out on insurance year over year over year over year. But that then sort of breaks a fundamental rule of society, at least in this country, which is I can live wherever I want, yeah, right? And if I have the means to have insurance, I don't, you know, I don't really have to worry about it because I know I'm going to be able to rebuild. I know this issue has been prevalent in California. I think it was the Paradise Fire that has led to a lot of these conversations about should communities rebuild in the same place or in the same areas. Very much the same case in Florida where they deal with hurricanes, of course. Then politics get involved, right? Because if you're a politician, you want to keep voters happy, and you certainly don't want people leaving the state, you know, especially if they're your constituency. So insurance is regulated in every state. And in a place like California, and California has an issue with this in earthquakes as well, but in a place like California and in Florida, you know, the state legislatures won't allow insurance companies to adequately price for the risk because it drives the price up and it becomes harder for people to pay for insurance, right? But they also won't let insurance companies leave the state because they want people to have insurance. So what's happening is the states themselves are beginning to put pools of money aside to help rebuild.
Right. And we're getting a little ahead of ourselves, and I want to ask one question. I don't want to go backwards.
Okay.
But I was reading up on this topic years ago, and now correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like the Fed or the federal government is backstopping a lot of this. And I started looking into it again, I believe, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm going to state kind of what my understanding is, and then you can clarify that or expand on it. But from my understanding is the National Flood Insurance Program is a massive federal program that's helping backstop Fannie and Freddie mortgages so that the actual insurance payments that people are making are nowhere near to what they should be. So for example, if you're buying a new home on the coast in Florida, your insurance won't reflect the risk that your home faces based off of climate projections. And therefore, if things get really bad, which is projected to happen, then the U.S. federal government is stuck between a rock and a hard place. And the U.S. taxpayers are actually the ones that are helping keep these people living where they are instead of people migrating to where they should live, you know, naturally based off of what's happening. So I'll stop there, but that's my basic understanding.
Yeah, I think the process that you described there is largely correct. I mean, I think the National Flood Insurance Program is not specifically geared for like hurricane protection. In fact, it wouldn't protect from a hurricane. But the notion that you're laying out there, that essentially the insurance rates are lower, they don't really reflect the risk at many properties because the government is there to step in and basically fill the gap when extra money is needed. I think that's largely correct. I mean, I think the state government and then the federal government are the ultimate insurers of last resort, essentially, in these types of catastrophes. And that then does mean that the taxpayer eventually pays it. You know, without straying too far into the politics of the whole thing, it's just a really interesting thing to think about because, again, I mean, we're sort of, our society is one that, you know, if I want to live where I want to live, right? I don't want to live maybe in the safest place from a climate or weather perspective. I want to live where, you know, maybe it's beautiful or maybe where my family grew up or maybe where my family's always been or California dreaming, right? I want to get to LA. And yet we don't, communities, when they suffer these kinds of losses, do have financial backstops. So, you know, many communities are not completely ruined. Some are, but many communities are not completely ruined when these types of weather events occur because, number one, you have the insurance company. Then number two and three, you've got, you know, government aid programs that come in on the back of it. It's a weird incentive structure, if you really think about it.
Right. So, I mean, is there a tipping point where we have such a biblical event or events that the federal government and the state government or this government in general cannot afford to help backstop these folks who have been impacted by it? And then they just have to let rates rise to where they should be, which will force people to move?
You know, it's a great question. I'm not an economist, so, you know, that's probably a good question for an economist if you can get one on your show. I mean, if you just sort of look at history, you can look back into the, you know, early 2000s in Florida with, you know, hurricane after hurricane after hurricane, year after year after year, many years having multiple hurricanes. And Florida has real issues in the insurance market, but I don't know that those are leading to, so number one, the insurance complex is not pricing people out, essentially, right? So they're not raising rates to a point where people are getting priced out. You know, I certainly haven't seen much in the way of stories of, you know, population changes out of Florida because it's getting more expensive because of all of these things. So, I mean, to your point on like an event that would truly be catastrophic throughout the economy, I tend to think that those probably build up over time.
Yeah.
And to me, the thing that I am most interested in watching now is the Colorado River issues, and the Hoover Dam, Lake Mead, Lake Powell. Because if that situation goes to where literally they hit Deadpool and no more water can flow through the, you know, through that infrastructure, that's gonna be a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how you fix that. You certainly can't fix it quickly.
No.
So, you know, and that's on a slow boil, right? So this issue was first identified around 2000, 2005, when researchers began to sort of lock in on this concept of mega drought and watching lake levels decline. I believe there were some studies done, you know, around 2005, probably out at UC San Diego, where there were some predictions made that 2020, 2030, sometime between 2020, 2030 in that time zone, there could be Deadpool issues. So the time to address the issue would have been in the middle.
What is a Deadpool issue? I get it means where the water is just so stagnant that we're not, say, for example, if there's hydro on that waterway, we're not producing energy that lots of people rely upon. We're impacting watersheds. So drinking water, so on and so forth. But what are the impacts of Deadpool issues?
Yeah. So what it means is that water can't flow through the dams. So you're literally not flowing water down the Colorado River from, through Arizona, New Mexico, and into California. Mm-hmm. So literally it means that the water's not coming because it can't flow through the dams. So it means what you said, like hydroelectric generation, you can't do it. No water's coming through. But it also means that the water supply for drinking and irrigation is also cut off. And for Southern California, there's especially a reliance on Colorado River. Now, California, I think, is first in line to get the water, even though they're last, in the flow geographically. I think Arizona and New Mexico have to cut off their pull from the river first. But if Deadpool comes, it doesn't matter, right? You're not flowing water anymore.
Wow. And this is happening real time.
So it has not happened yet. And certainly there are chances that over the next couple of years, if we get a good wet pattern in the West, some good snowpack, things can start to build back. But the projections now are that we could hit Deadpool within the next 5 years if the type of drought conditions that have been seen over the last couple of years persist. Mm-hmm.
And what would be some of the impacts of that? What would happen, do you think?
I mean, it's a really good question. I mean, so first of all, like, water supply is going to be a problem for municipalities and for cities. I mean, San Diego, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, all of those are going to have issues with supply of water. So they're going to have to figure out where to get water other than the Colorado River. And I would imagine I know San Diego has been working on this. So I know San Diego over the last 20 years has been changing where their water supply comes from. But if you can imagine, if you're trying to just say you want to do desal, right? Yeah. Desalization, a desal plant can't be built in a month, right? I mean, it's reasonably, that's a multi-year potentially in California with the issues you've got to go through with regulatory stuff, could be a 10-year time period before you're operational. Mm-hmm. So, I think the issue is water supply is going to become an issue. Does that mean that there's no drinking water? I don't know. Probably not. I mean, that seems pretty dire. But, I think certainly for agriculture use, we're already seeing issues, meaning if you've been out through, if you've ever done the drive from San Diego to Las Vegas, you go through those areas in Southern California. I guess that drive doesn't actually go through Yuma, does it? It's out the other way through to Arizona. So if you're going out to Phoenix, you're going to go through Yuma. But you come through Southern California, and Yuma is like right on the border of Arizona and California. And you're in the desert, and all of a sudden there's this just lush greenery everywhere around you because of all the agriculture there. That is already being cut. So the amount of water for irrigation, I think it starts with alfalfa because alfalfa is the lowest cost, the lowest price crop grown out there. So that's the first thing that goes when there's no water is they stop the alfalfa or the alfalfa withers. But agriculture would be a big one to get the hit first.
Mm. And this is not just happening in the United States, right? I was reading an article about the Yangtze River in China and how they're having this historic heat wave and drought there. And I mean, I don't know if they've gotten to Deadpool events, but they're facing something very similar as we are here.
They are indeed. And there I saw that, so heat and drought sort of go together, right? Yeah. So if you think about when you're in a situation where there's not a lot of rain, the ground dries out. And in many areas, when the ground dries out, it basically gets hotter, essentially. When it gets hotter, the pressure pattern starts to change. And when the pressure pattern starts to change, you can actually deflect weather. You can deflect rainstorms around it, right? So you start to build high pressure over an area. And that can often prevent significant rainfall from occurring. So it can be a propagation event. And that's in the the issue in China is really dramatic. I mean, 100 million people have been experiencing afternoon temperatures of 105 degrees plus. There is the issue there. There's also the issue in Europe. Europe is also suffering from drought. We've seen stories on river levels dropping. So it's the confluence of these events that I think is the concerning thing for the economy, just in general, global economy, is when these things happen at the same time in lots of different places. Because if there's a drought in the U.S., in the U.S. West, the issues with food supply will shift very, very quickly. You know, in the United States, we can produce we can produce vegetables in lots of places. You know, we can also import. But when you've got the issues in the United States, in Europe, and China all at the same time, that's when you actually start to see impacts on global economy, because one area can't make up for another one.
Yeah, I was actually in Paris during that heat wave a month ago. I literally went into Paris to speak at something, and that's right when the heat wave hit, and it was miserable.
Did you have AC?
We actually, this is funny enough, we had an Airbnb, and we ended up having to give up our Airbnb and stay in a hotel because they had AC and the Airbnb didn't. Yeah. So there is currently, I don't believe there's any climate change insurance for Airbnb, but who knows? That might become a thing.
Well, that's actually, I mean, that's part of what my life entails now, is exactly, not specifically for Airbnb, although it's a great idea. We'll go after them next.
There you go.
but yeah, the notion of compensating the person that owns the Airbnb for the lost revenue when it was hot and you went to the hotel, that is generally the concept that we've built this company around. Not specifically Airbnb, but that same concept.
Actually, we lost money because they wouldn't return our fee. So it's either, and I was with somebody and that person has, you know, some, let's just say, asthma issues, and was like, yeah, I can't stay there. And so it could potentially be a health issue for this person. And we were like, sorry, we can't stay there because of this potential health issue because of the heat wave. And they still want to return the money. Airbnb, of course, want to do anything. So we're out all that money.
Yeah.
That Airbnb for 3 days.
Yeah. And then going to a hotel. That's a great opportunity for Airbnb as a company, not the owner of the unit that you are in, right? But for Airbnb as a company, there is a fantastic opportunity there to build customer experience. So imagine if Airbnb had reimbursed you, right? You know, so the owner got paid, right? Because you paid. You had to leave because there was no AC and it got super hot. Imagine if Airbnb came back in to reimburse you. I mean,
wow. Yeah. The loyalty, customer loyalty for life there.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm going to go there because we're already talking a little bit about it, and why not? As I mentioned before this session, I've been digging into climate migration. And of course, that has a lot or almost everything to do with weather. And you were just pointing out that, well, if this happens in one geographic area but not another at the same time, we can deal with that. But if it's happening in all different geographic areas at once, and it just keeps on getting worse and worse and worse, this will force people to migrate north, as we know. And I'm curious, from your perspective, where you see people moving to. And, you know, if it was like, hey, Matt, if I were you, I would move to the three zip codes. And I can say I actually found a report that shows, breaking down by zip code in the United States, which zip codes will net benefit from climate change and which ones will be the most heavily impacted. So that's a lot to unpack there, but it's really at the top of my mind, and I think a lot of people's minds right now.
Yeah. It's a really interesting issue. It doesn't set itself up for a single answer because it really depends on what motivates you as an individual, like why you choose to live where you choose to live. And everybody's got different sort of thought processes around that. It also has a lot to do with infrastructure. So for example, the idea of kind of people moving north, right? So it, just think about the West Coast because you're in the Bay Area. So if San Diego, Los Angeles are getting warmer pretty regularly, do people migrate north to San Francisco and to Portland and Seattle, right? The challenge with that is that when you're in a place like, so in San Diego, if you're near the coast, you probably don't have air conditioning, right? A lot of the houses near the coast don't. But if you're inland, you definitely have air conditioning because it gets hot inland, right? In Seattle, I forget the exact stat, but it's, I think it's less than 50% of residential units have air conditioning in Seattle. And Seattle, like the Pacific Northwest, is an area where significant heat events in summertime are becoming far more common. It was it last year or the year before that we had the extreme heat wave in the Pacific Northwest where temperatures were 110, 120 degrees. The temperatures were more than 10 degrees above normal in the middle of the summer, which is just unheard of. In this, you know, in the summertime, you expect to break records by a degree or two, not by 15 or 20. But it's the areas farther north that are experiencing heat to that degree in a way that they haven't before. And the infrastructure is not there to deal with it. There's not air conditioning. So if you're migrating to Seattle to escape the heat, you're actually putting yourself in a worse situation because you're suffering from these extreme events and you don't have air conditioning, essentially. So it really kind of depends on what sort of what your base state, like what you're looking for is. You know, it's easy to say people would leave Florida to get away from hurricanes, but go back to the insurance thing. If I've got a house in Florida and I know that my insurance company is going to rebuild it if a hurricane comes, I know I can escape the hurricane. I can get in my car and get out of there. You know, why would I leave? Why would I move? Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting discussion, but it's not a one size fits all analysis, I think.
Right. So what do you see happening? What do you project happening, say, in the next 20 years?
So, I mean, I think there are issues in the West. So with water issues and fire, I think if we're going in this country, if we're going to see major migration due to climate issues, it's probably going to be from the West to areas in the Midwest or East. A big part of that, I think, is going to be water, because I think again, that's something that can affect a very large area all at the same time. You know, fire too. I only say fire because I don't know. Like I said, I lived in the Bay Area and I was there in 2017 and 2019, you know, the big fire years when, you know, literally we couldn't go outside. There were no fires near my house, right? But the air quality was so horrible. I mean, you have to remember this too, the pictures of San Francisco with the red sky, like Mars.
Yeah.
And those issues are not, I mean, those issues are imminently livable, right? You just stay inside. You know, we had HEPA filters in the house, right? You change them out after the smoke. When we lived in the East Bay, we were at the whim of PG&E cutting power to try to stop fires, right? But we had solar on the house, we had batteries, so we didn't really lose power. So there are ways to adapt. But I just kind of feel like when you add stuff up, when you have water issues and you're dealing with these air quality issues, and you're dealing with California's financial structure trying to also deal with these things, meaning the taxes and high cost of living just generally, you know, suddenly it's just like, okay, there's enough reason to move, you know, if you can take your professional life with you.
Yeah, I was also eyeing the Midwest and the Northeast. Then I found that an issue with the Midwest could be what they called wet bulb situations, right? Yeah. Where maybe the temperature on, when you look at the number, might not seem that hot, but because of the humidity there, because of the Great Lakes, it's really hot. And so that's an asterisk for me. So I'm looking at the Northeast. I'm like, geez, Maine and Vermont and these areas, I think we're just going to have, like, these cities are just going to expand. We'll have brand new towns of people moving there because of just how bad it gets in some of these very dense urban areas that are going to be very negatively impacted by the weirding of the weather.
Yeah. Yeah. The wet bulb issue in the Midwest is interesting. So, you know, the issue there is that nighttime temperatures are getting much warmer. And while some of that's due to humidity off the Great Lakes, a lot of it is actually due to wet soil and to crops. So there's a, I think they call it corn sweat or something like that. Like, I think if you live in Illinois, there is a time of year where the corn is at a certain point where it's literally perspiring, and that's causing the whole area to be more humid. So you'll see, and this is where you get big health issues in a place like Chicago, is when that air mass moves into the Chicago area, and at night it doesn't go below 85 degrees, and in the afternoon it's 95 degrees. And if you don't have air conditioning in that kind of a situation, you're in trouble from a health perspective. Now, you know, much of the Midwest is building AC. So, I mean, the nice thing about these heat issues is we can manage it with air conditioning. Of course, we have to have the power infrastructure to do it, and we have to think about the emissions issues and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, AC gives us the ability to adapt to heat. But I think you're right. I mean, if somebody was just sort of taking the sort of the climate migration topic at the surface level and saying, okay, where would be the best place to go? Where's the best climate going to be? You know, head to Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, upstate New York.
Yeah.
Well, I think Canada is going to do pretty well.
Canada is going to do great.
Yeah.
I was thinking about what's really important to me, because you asked that, you said that it depends what's important to you. And I realized that community is extremely important. So if any cool folks listening want to, which everybody listening is cool, obviously, wants to form a community in any of these areas, which will be climate resilient, just hit me up and we'll see if we get along and see what we can do.
That's actually a fascinating, that's really neat. That's a neat idea. There should be a thing around that, actually. Yeah. Vermont would be the place to go, right? Like that's that would be the area that would accept the climate, what would you call them? Like the climate pioneers or
I like
something
that.
Like that.
So we're not going to do refugees.
I was going to skip that one. That one didn't have the connotation I was looking for.
Oh, you Bay Area climate refugees. No, yeah. Well, I like the pioneer word, climate pioneers. That's terrific. So I don't have enough time to do another startup. Now I am already starting my second business. But if anybody wants to tackle that, let me know. I want to invest in somebody who's doing it right. So who knows? Maybe Airbnb will just go do it. Now that we're talking about him so much, they'll be like, that's great. Or what's his name from Adam Newman? You know, maybe that's his.
There you go. There you go.
Move, and we just don't even realize it. Yeah, well, hey, we've gotten so far ahead of ourselves, which is beautiful. At the same time, I want to let people know a little bit more about you and why the heck we're talking about weather with you, because, correct me if I'm wrong, you've been in weather for 30 years?
About that, yeah. So I graduated with my degree in meteorology in 95. So we're not quite to 30 years, but we're getting close to it.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to date you. I was trying to show that you have an expertise.
Yeah, I've been doing weather for a long time. I started my career as a very typical meteorologist. I was told early in my career that I have a face for radio, so I was never really on television. I did work for the Weather Channel for a bit, but pretty much behind the scenes. There are a lot of forecasting jobs, or at that time, there were a lot of forecasting jobs that somebody with an undergrad in meteorology forecast for newspapers, for radio, that kind of thing. And went to the Weather Channel around 98 to 2000, which was a really fun job as a meteorologist. As a young meteorologist, there's no cooler place than the Weather Channel, especially at that time.
Yeah. And so to clarify, you were not like Prick from Anchorman.
Right.
Although I think, you know, he had a face for radio, at least in that movie. Okay.
Yeah. I was very happy when you said we weren't going to be using any of the video from this recording. Because
No. You're very handsome guy. Don't worry. Yeah. It's why was it so cool to work at the Weather Channel at that time?
I mean, I guess I've always had a fascination with communication as well. So it's just the neatest thing ever to be, you know, all the meteorology people were actually in the studio. So, you know, the green screens were literally 25 yards away from the desk. You know, if you sneezed really loudly in those days, they would hear you on air. So it was just really neat. And the group of people that were there at that time, and I think still today, but the group of people that were there at that time were so passionate about weather. I think what you find is if you or any of your listeners here know a meteorologist, they probably know that meteorologist is just a little bit crazy to some degree. Like there's something there's something off in a meteorologist's head that draws them to weather. They're just so passionate about weather.
Mm-hmm. So what makes you crazy?
Well, so probably the story,
I'm really sorry.
The story that would go best there is when I was, before I started studying meteorology, so I was the summer between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college, my brother and his wife were stationed in Newport, Rhode Island. You know, it was my summer between high school and college. They invited me up to spend some time with them. And so I was going to go up for, you know, a week and a half, 2 weeks, something like that, get a really good vacation before I started studying meteorology. Before I got on the plane to go north, so probably a week prior to the trip, you know, I'm a weather geek, so I watch the weather a lot. And I see that there's a storm forming. There's a tropical storm forming, you know, way out in the Atlantic. You know, the forecast's like, oh, you know, could this affect the East Coast? And, you know, as an 18-year-old, I'm like, ooh, that could be fun, right? It could be fun to have a hurricane. And so the forecasts are coming out. I fly up. I get off the plane. My brother picks me up. And in the car on the way back to their house in Newport, I'm like, have you seen the forecast for the hurricane? My brother's like, what hurricane? And I was like, there could be a hurricane here in a couple of days. And he is like, yeah, whatever. So flash forward, for anybody that knows weather, that was Hurricane Bob, which was a Category 3 landfall in Rhode Island.
Wow.
The eye passed right over Newport. So we got to go through the whole ramp up to the storm, right? Had to prepare the house. We didn't evacuate. We were in a zone that was high enough up that it wasn't going to flood. But you asked me the crazy part. So my mother would tell you I was crazy. And my mother would tell you that my brother is the worst person in the world because he let me sit on the front porch of this house throughout the entire hurricane and basically just watch it. I watched the trees bend, you know, like 90 degrees over. When the eye came in, we went walking around in the, you know, in the complete calm.
Oh.
Then the wind comes back from the other direction. And, you know, my mom's just happy I'm alive. I didn't think about danger at that point. It was just like, this is the coolest thing ever.
And we're not recommending folks do this on their own.
Yeah. That's true. You need some, you got to have some professional storm chasing credentials before you do something like this. But the worst part of the whole thing was following the hurricane. So the lead up was really exciting, very fun. The storm itself was awesome. And then we were without power for 2 weeks, which was terrible.
Yeah. And speaking of power, let's talk about your time at Enron. I mean, let's do it. And you know what? I can almost guess that a lot of people listening to this, because many of them are, I'd say, between the ages of 23 and 32, 33, might not even know about Enron. I mean, I hate to dismiss folks, but let's just say I don't know if like young millennials and Gen Z really know what happened. So we don't even have to touch upon that part of it.
Well, it is interesting. And I teach a class out at UC San Diego every summer, and I won't go into a lot of detail on this, but part of the buildup for this class, there's a little bit of Enron story. And every year I ask how many people in the room have heard of Enron. Mm. These are master's students, so they're a little bit older, but they're definitely in the age range that you just described. And just over the last 2 or 3 years, I've gotten to a point where maybe one person in the room, maybe two, have heard of Enron. But prior to that, it was a lot more. But now we're down to very few. The punchline there was that Enron was the corporate scandal of its age, of, you know, the early 2000s, right? And, you know, you said speaking of power, which was a big part of what Enron did. Thankfully, I did not work for the power desk at Enron. I worked on the natural gas desk. We were the good guys. The power guys were the bad guys.
Yeah, bad guys.
Especially in California, right? Yeah. Probably a lot of people listening to this have no idea what we're talking about.
No, well, there's some books written on it. If people want to go check it out, that was a pretty bad situation, but not you, but not your team.
That's right. I'll give you how you knew and how I knew Enron was a really weird place. I'll also sort of tell you what we did. So let me do that first, I guess. I went from the Weather Channel to Enron. I had never heard of Enron before they called me. So I literally got a call one day out of the blue from a company I'd never heard of in Houston, Texas, that was looking to hire weather people, hire meteorologists. And I was very happy at the Weather Channel, but you know, one of the tenets I followed throughout my career is always when opportunity knocks, you always open the door and at least hear what it has to say. Mm-hmm. So I went to the interview at Enron, and I mean, I guess the short end of what Enron did is it owned energy production facilities, natural gas, electricity. It also bought and sold energy commodities, natural gas, electricity, and a bunch of other stuff. So the idea was the, you know, the I worked on the natural gas trading floor. So my role was to, along with three other meteorologists, we put together a demand forecast, a temperature forecast. Because if you think about the demand for natural gas, the biggest variable in the demand for natural gas is temperature. So a lot of industrial facilities use natural gas to make things, chemicals, that sort of stuff. They burn a lot of natural gas. But that demand is generally fixed. Like the plant's either running or it's not. So it's not, there's not a lot of variation in that from day to day. But in the wintertime, when it gets really cold, a lot of home heating uses natural gas to heat your home. So when it's extremely cold in the wintertime, the natural gas usage goes way up. When the natural gas usage goes way up, the price tends to go way up with it. So it's a supply-demand relationship. If the demand is going up, the supply is remaining fixed, then you have a price spike, essentially. So that's what our team was doing, was helping the trading floor predict the price of natural gas. So they would buy low and sell high, or sell high and buy low. So my job was basically to forecast the weather, convert that into natural gas terms so that the traders would understand sort of, they turned it into price, essentially. So we'd come in, we'd make the forecast, we'd spend the morning walking around the trading floor. We each had our specific traders that were our customers, essentially, we went and talked to about the weather. And to give you just a high-level sense of the weird place that Enron was, I'll never forget the day that I went. So the Texas trading desk was part of one of my customers.
The wildest, heaviest drinking bunch.
Well, it's funny because I was just about to say, if you picture in your head what you think the head of the Texas natural gas trading desk looks like, sounds like, and acts like, and it is exactly the stereotype.
Yeah.
He was a great guy, but he was exactly the stereotype. So I'll never forget the day I went over to brief the desk. I walked over to the desk and he stood up, big guy, right? He stood up and he slaps me on the back. He's like, Steve, this was on a Monday. He said, Steve, nice forecast on Friday. He's like, we made $1 million off the weather derivatives, guys. And I looked at him like, what? And he's like, yeah. He's like, we just made $1 million. And I said, off the weather derivatives, guys. And he's like, yeah. So what had happened was there was a group of meteorologists that worked on the natural gas trading desk. There was a meteorologist who worked on the weather derivatives trading desk, which was two floors down from the natural gas trading desk. We were always competing with forecasts. So essentially, my forecast was more accurate than his forecast. And the Texas trader had traded with the weather derivatives traders on my forecast versus his forecast. And mine was right. So I looked at that, I'm like, didn't $1 million just get on the elevator, go up two floors and get off? Like, isn't it still in the building? Like,
yeah, weird.
How is this good for the company that money just went up two floors?
Yeah, well, it ended up not being too good for them, I guess.
Yeah, it didn't work out well in the long run.
But regardless, I'm pointing out Enron because they had to have a very good weather team for the business that they had, and clearly you were very good because you were on it. And then after that, you went to Citadel.
That's right. Yeah.
And what were you doing there?
It was the same thing. So, I mean, I guess back to the Enron thing for one second. So Enron was really a pioneer in bringing weather into commodities analysis. And that had a lot to do with the CEO. At one point, the CEO of Enron was Jeff Skilling. Anybody who's lived in Chicago for any period of time knows Tom Skilling, probably one of the most famous weathercasters of all time that there has ever been. You know, maybe I'm dating myself a little bit, but I'm not dating myself too far. Like Tom's pretty well known in the Chicago area. You notice Skilling on both the last names. They're brothers. So Jeff Skilling at Enron knew from Tom Skilling, his brother, how important the weather was to commodities pricing.
Interesting.
And that was exactly why Enron built a weather desk the way it did. And when Enron did it, you know, all of the others in the energy complex realized the same thing and began building energy and began building weather desks as well. So, you know, the end of Enron was bankruptcy in a blaze of scandal, none of which I had anything to do with.
You're just the weather guy.
I'm just the weather guy. And I'll tell you what, as an early career professional, I was in my late 20s at that point, right? Like, that was a really interesting experience. I had only been at Enron for a year and a half when it went under. So I didn't have a pension and a whole lot of stock and all that sort of stuff. I didn't lose a lot other than my job when Enron went under. And the experience of going through that was something for a early career person.
Yeah. It's like being at Lehman during the crash.
Yeah. I mean, Lehman is a very similar story, right?
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. So at Citadel, you were doing something similar?
Yeah. So when Enron was headed down, Ken Griffin from Citadel, he's been in the news lately. Ken Griffin from Citadel came down to Houston and basically knew that Enron was going to collapse. And he also knew that there were a lot of smart people at Enron. So he came in and basically was looking to bring in a group of people to come to Citadel and build an energy trading business. And like I said, I was like 28 at the time. He wasn't looking for me. He was, however, looking for my boss's boss. And my boss's boss is Vince Kaminsky. Today he's a professor at Rice University, you know, very well known in that day in the energy universe. So Ken came down looking to try to get Vince to come and build an energy trading unit for Citadel. And Vince eventually agreed to come, but only if he could bring six people with him. He said, I'll come build it, but these are the six people we need to start it. And so I happened to be one of those six people that Vince wanted to come with him. So when Citadel built an energy trading business, of the seven people that were hired to start it, you know, one including Vince, four of us were meteorologists and the other three were applied mathematicians. So it just goes to show the importance of weather in the commodities, in energy commodities at that time. And that was, well, that was like 02, probably 02, 03, somewhere around there. And so we basically built the energy trading business at Citadel. I was at Citadel for 6 years. The first four or so were in energy. So we did natural gas, we did electricity, we did a little bit of weather derivatives. We didn't really do any agriculture at that time. I think Citadel has done some agriculture since then, but not during that time. And then the last 2 years I was at Citadel, I switched over. That was following the big hurricane years in Florida that I referred to earlier. Following those hurricane years, reinsurance rates were going up. So there had been a lot of damage in Florida. And basically what was happening is the reinsurance markets can price risk. So there was a feeling that hurricane risk in Florida was increasing. So people are paying more for reinsurance, which is basically reinsurance is just insurance for an insurance company. And at that time, Citadel saw an investment opportunity that said, you know, we can get in on this while the rates are rising. And so Citadel started two reinsurance companies that were Bermuda based. And my group in Chicago, we split off a small group to basically build the weather and the modeling program for the Bermuda companies. So that was my last couple of years at Citadel.
Got it. And since then, you've been on the entrepreneurial track, right? I guess if we could, I know it's hard because you've been at this for so long. If we could summarize all of that and feed into what you are doing now, I think that would be great. Because the picture I'm trying to paint with the limited time that we have is that from what I see, and correct me if I'm wrong, what you're doing now is an evolution from what you have been doing since almost 30 years.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Basically, my whole career has been, I joke that I'm the only meteorologist you'll ever meet that says nobody cares about the weather. They only care about what they have to do because of the weather. Mm-hmm. And the first part of my career in media, it was all about, you know, do you need to bring an umbrella to work or something like that? Because I mean, that's what you do because of the weather. As soon as I went to Enron, it all changed to financial implications, right? Is do you buy or sell natural gas because of the weather? Same thing at Citadel. I left Citadel pre-crash in 08. to go out to UC San Diego. So that's how I, a lot of my references to UC San Diego is because I spent considerable time there. I made that move because I wanted to, I sort of had the thought that climate was going to become the center of the economic universe. You know, short deviation there. At Citadel, we were working on a project that was looking at natural gas price. And we were trying to predict the price of natural gas. We were in the summer, so it was like July, and we're trying to predict the price of natural gas in February of the following year. So weather forecast is not going to help you with that, right? So what you do is you take the history, you take the past. And so what we did is we took every one of the winters for the last 30 years, and we put them through the pricing models at Citadel. And what we found when we did that was two of the last 30 years would exhaust storage of natural gas. We would run out of natural gas in the United States because it was so cold. So these were the winters of the late 70s. If those winters happened again exactly, we would run out of natural gas in the United States. So that means the price would go to infinity. Our traders are like, what's the real probability of that? Because it's probably not 2 over 30, right? It's probably something different than that. And oh, by the way, does climate change have anything to do with the odds of seeing those cold winters again? And at this point, I didn't know anything about climate. I mean, I was a meteorologist forecasting the weather. In fact, a lot of what I had done early in my career was talk about how climate change was problematic, how the science behind climate change was problematic. You can find an interview that I did on WORAM in New York in the late 90s talking about the flaws in climate science. So at this point at Citadel, we didn't know. I was just like, I don't know. How do we find out? We got to go find out. So we made a connection out at Scripps in UC San Diego, Scripps Oceanography, where a lot of climate research is done. We basically made a connection there to learn what they were doing. And I had an opportunity to go out and visit, and I went in to visit them with all of the reasons in my mind why climate change was not something we needed to worry about, certainly not something we needed to factor into commodities prices. I had a list of 10 things that I went in there, basically, and I asked the climate scientists my list of 10 questions, and they were so patient, and they were so good at explaining the science behind climate change. I'll never forget the flight back to Chicago from San Diego. I felt like I had been committing professional malpractice for years because I'm like, there's a whole body of science that I was completely unaware of. So after that dawned on me and I went back to Citadel, I'm like, this is going to be, the whole economy is going to change based on what those guys know and nobody else has really picked up on yet. Like I said, this is 2006, 2007. So, you know, long story short, eventually had an opportunity to go out and work for UC San Diego with the whole idea of putting together commercial applications for the research that was going on there. That was why I went to UC San Diego. One of the projects that we worked on was a weather forecasting model that went out about 40 days into the future. We worked with the climate research division at Scripps to develop this. When we finished the project, it was a great research study. There was a whole lot of maps and data and charts and all the stuff that came out of it. And we worked with some financial backers in San Diego to write software around that research. And so we basically started a company that spun out of UCSD to do 40-day weather forecasting. Our primary customer were hedge funds, and Citadel was a customer at the time. And so basically there it was starting to put forecasting into an economic context again.
Yeah.
That company, again, long story, that company eventually pivoted, as many startups do, pivoted into supply chain. And so we combined with a really cutting edge weather application in that day. This was probably close to 2015, 2014, somewhere around there. One of the companies that had done one of the first storm tracking applications, we came across them. They had some fantastic software and application. We had a lot of science. They didn't have any weather expertise, but they had a really cool UI, and their UI was used by the White House for hurricane tracking. So we put the two companies together. We brought in the science. They had the cool visualizations, and we turned the whole thing around to start looking at supply chain. And that was what we wound up building the business around. We We worked with a major consumer goods company that makes a whole lot of mayonnaise, and they move a lot of mayonnaise from Chicago to California. And we helped that company understand when they needed to run refrigeration versus when they didn't need to run refrigeration. So they could basically save $1,000 a shipment if they turned off the refrigeration on the, you know, on the vehicle that was transporting the mayonnaise, but they didn't want it to spoil, right? But the technology was there to do it. And once we got there, we started doing it for mayo first and then beer next, and then basically started working out from there. About 5 years later, we were approached by a private equity group and that had a component from DHL, the big yellow planes, big yellow trucks, the shipping company, that approached us to basically buy the company to embed the supply chain analytics for DHL's customer network, essentially. That company is today Everstream Analytics. So we sold that in 2019. That gave me a chance to exit. At that point, I touched back in with some people I had worked with at Citadel around 2005. And the lead founder for Demex was in the process at that point of starting a company that would basically do all financial protections from weather and climate events. So essentially it's insurance for extreme weather events, but not tornadoes and hailstorms and stuff like that. It's for the smaller types. It's for the Airbnb example you talked about before. So it's new innovative types of things where people lose money or spend a lot of money because the weather got really hot or got really cold or got really rainy or got really snowy or it didn't snow. It's basically providing financial protection for businesses that are exposed to the weather in that way. And so our lead founder was basically starting this company in late 2019, right as I exited from RiskPulse. I connected with him and he's like, you know, we're starting this thing. I'm like, sounds like fun. So here we are.
Wow. Yeah. And so can you describe a bit more or go into a bit more? Is it essentially you're providing, I mean, we're not going to call Airbnb a small business owner, but are you also providing, say, like small business owners, say even a bar in Miami that might be exposed to flooding, some insurance so that they can cover for when there is a climate event?
That's a great example. So not flooding, but a bar in Miami that is a rooftop bar in Miami where they have very small square footage inside, but very large square footage outside, and people don't come when it's raining. It's that kind of thing. The business started with snow, actually, so get out of Miami, but the business started with snow where we're working actually with large property management companies. So you know, you see signs like Cushman Wakefield and JLL, you see those on the side of buildings. Like, so we're talking about major, large companies that manage big portfolios of properties. A lot of these are malls and commercial office buildings, shopping malls and commercial office buildings. They have to keep the parking lots clear, right? So when it snows, they've got to basically clear the snow out of the parking lot. Snow removal budgets can vary, you know, two or three times from 1 year to the next. So it's almost impossible to plan a stationary budget from year to year if you're doing that. So where we actually started the business was providing what looks like an insurance product to the property manager that says you will never pay more than X amount to clear snow. So you pay a premium up front to us at the start of the season or to our risk carrier. If it snows a lot, you basically have an insurance claim. You get a reimbursement. If it doesn't snow a lot, well, you didn't want it to snow a lot anyway. So you paid for insurance, but you didn't get a claim payment. That was where we started. The future of where we're going is very much the bar in Miami. Like that's where we see a massive opportunity. We're already providing a product through an insurance company to small businesses. And this was a direct result of the cold event in Texas when you saw the pipes freezing in Houston and Austin a couple of years ago. Vave is the company that we're working with, the insurance company. Now in their business insurance policies, when you get a business insurance policy from Vave, it has a cold weather protection baked in it. You don't have to buy it separately. Yeah. It's just there. And if the temperature drops to a severe cold level where you are, where your business is, there's an assumption that if the temperature gets that cold, you're going to be suffering some increased cost in your business or lost revenue, mm-hmm. and you'll receive a claim payment that ranges from, I think they start at $250 and go up to like $1,500. Mm-hmm. And that's where we see the future is. Our view is that every insurance company in the marketplace should have these kinds of coverages, and it should just be inside your homeowner's insurance. Mm. So here in North Carolina, number one, you can get a little bit more land than you can in the Bay Area. And when you have a little bit more land, there's a little bit more landscaping. And when it rains really hard, a lot of stuff washes away, and you've got to go out and replace that stuff if you want your lawn to keep, you know, looking the way it's supposed to. In the wintertime, you know, if your irrigation system freezes because you didn't blow it out early enough. So you can imagine in a homeowner's policy, those kind of things are just, they're nitpicky little expenses when they happen, but they, you know, they can be $500, $1,000, $200. So these kind of payments just sort of help the homeowner build resilience, essentially, following these kind of events.
Yeah, totally. And I'm guessing that your secret sauce lies in the weather models that you use. And if you don't mind going just a few minutes over, I'd love to help people understand how weather models work and how they're improving.
Okay. So I'll start by saying that our secret sauce at Demex is not actually the weather models. Mm-hmm. We can come back to that. I want to answer your weather model question. But weather models are very important to what we do. The reason I say that the secret sauce is not the weather model is because there are so many organizations that build great weather models. The difference, when you have a better weather model, it's actually only slightly better than the one that's slightly worse. Mm. Yeah, the stupid example of this is just if you've got weather on an app on your phone, and if you have a couple of weather apps on your phone, it's hard to say which one's actually better.
Yeah.
You know, one of them will be better sometimes, another one will be better other times. And that's the case in weather modeling generally. But to answer your question on weather models, so the way a weather model works is you basically take the globe, you take the world, and you overlay a mesh onto the globe. So it's a grid. So if you could picture the globe covered in, you know, like a screen. Mm-hmm. So lots of little boxes, essentially. That's where we start, is basically creating a grid in a computer model. Now, if you think about how the world works, we're actually working in four dimensions here, right? So we're working in three dimensions spatially. So you can't just have one screen overlaying the Earth. There might be one at the surface, mm-hmm. but then there's one that's 10,000 feet up, and then there's one at 20,000 feet up, and there's one at 30,000 feet up. So you've basically got these grids that go all the way up to, you know, 50,000, 80,000, 100,000 feet in altitude. The fourth dimension is time. So you have to think backward in time, what's been observed, and you're forecasting forward in time. So the way the computer model works is it's got all of these meshes going up and down from the surface of the Earth to the top of the atmosphere. And we're now putting equations into each of those boxes that are replicating the physics of the atmosphere inside that box. Mm-hmm. So the fundamental laws of physics sit inside there and basically say, okay, if this much solar radiation is going in and this much solar radiation is being reflected back out, what is the temperature of an air parcel inside that box? Mm-hmm. What direction is that parcel moving? Is it moving up, down, left, right, north, south, east, west, et cetera? So that's the basic of what a computer model, of what a weather model is. When you see people talking about the, like if you're a Weather Channel geek, you'll see people talk about the American model or the European model. That's what they're talking about, are these big computer models that do this. The reason they've gotten better, and they have gotten a lot better, forecasting has gotten a whole lot better over the last couple of decades. And the reason for that is multiple things. So first, in order to model the weather, you have to be able to know what the current state is. So think about an air parcel. If you know exactly where that air parcel is, you know exactly what all of its characteristics are, that's a pretty good starting point to forecast what's going to happen next with it. Mm. If you're off, if that air parcel is actually two feet away, 2 miles away, right? If you're in the wrong place or if you've got the wrong temperature, your model's going to go wrong in a hurry, right? So this is sort of the butterfly effect that, people talk about. 25 years ago, we did not have weather observations in a lot of places, especially over the oceans. You know, go back farther than that. Go back 50 years ago, right? 50 years ago, there were very few things floating around in the ocean that were measuring weather. There were almost no satellites that were measuring the weather at various altitudes. The ones that we did have even 25 years ago weren't very good at finding that air parcel because you're trying to find it from space, right? So if you can't initialize properly, you can't forecast well. Mm. And we had big gaps over the oceans where there just were no weather observations. We had big gaps over countries that didn't have a lot of population, where there were no airports. There were no, even in this country, we had big gaps in data. So over the last 3 or 4 decades, the number of observations that we have for weather have increased dramatically. Satellites have gotten a lot better. We have a lot more things floating around in the ocean that are doing these measurements. Every airplane that flies, you know, every commercial aircraft has weather sensors on it. So they're taking, and they're all reporting in to the weather agencies to initialize these models. And we've built a lot more surface networks. So, you know, again, to come back to San Diego, one of the things that happened in San Diego following the fire, the major fire out there, I think it was 2007, is that San Diego Gas and Electric went out and put almost 200 new weather sensors just in San Diego County alone.
Wow.
So just in that spot. And so now we've got a lot more accurate picture of what things look like every minute of every day. So that's the first thing. Second thing is that computing power has just increased dramatically, right? So if you think about all of those meshes, all of those grids, all of that data, when you're actually trying to take every air parcel around the world and forecast where it's moving, requires a lot of horsepower to do it. So, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, the boxes in that grid had to be pretty big because you have to do a whole lot of calculations for every box that you have. So if you only had one box and it was the whole world, right, you only have to do one calculation. Every time you add a box, you've got to do another calculation for every time you're trying to forecast for. So if you're forecasting 1 hour in advance, 2 hours in advance, 3 hours in advance, every one, you've got to do calculations. So you can see how by adding horsepower to that, just simple computing power, you're going to get better. You can make those boxes smaller. And the smaller you can make those boxes, the better, the more precise your forecast can be. So that's been another major advancement that's helped forecasts really improve.
Mm. And so what is Demex's special sauce, if you're allowed to say?
So our special sauce is connecting the weather to the economics of a particular situation. So it's the link between the weather and the economic impact. And the core of our technology is really about pricing the risk. So when we talk about a climate appraisal, you'll hear a lot of people talk about climate assessments. We talk about a climate appraisal. Our technology will take a client's business. So that it'll actually take the costs or the revenue, whatever it is that's affected by weather. We'll actually work with them to help determine what is affected by weather. So if I try to use our Airbnb example from the beginning, what do I need to know? Well, I need to know how many cancellations have happened, right? So I need to know what was going on during those cancellations. Was it weather driven or was it, you know, something else going on? Mm-hmm. So we work with first party data, so client's data. Our technology will determine the relevant weather characteristics that affect the economics of that business. We'll then run a baseline scenario and a climate adjusted scenario. So we'll actually be able to quantify the difference in cost or revenue that is specifically linked to a change in climate, because climate change is already affecting us. We don't have to wait 50 years for it to happen. It's already here. Mm-hmm. So that allows us to price the risk. And what our core value proposition is for our customers, all of that. But then we basically produce a dollar value for which that risk can be protected, a premium price for an insurance policy, essentially.
Great. Perfect. Well, we're out of time here and we're going to go to the questions that we have. And I like to say, hope that this isn't, that this is proven to be a value add conversation for you. And I hope that Airbnb does come through. And who knows, maybe Adam Neumann and Flow Carbon too, right? They get on all the fun and stuff like that. So let's go to the books question. What are three books that have greatly influenced the way that you think and approach life?
Absolutely. So one of them is probably the top one on my list is going to be Made to Stick by Chip and Dan Heath. Why Some Ideas Survive and Others Fail and Others Die. It is all about how to get your message across in a way that's going to, that your audience is going to remember it. The reason this one resonates so well for me is just because I've been in the scientific community for my entire career. And I just think that scientists aren't always the best at this. And mm-hmm. I think the Heath brothers do a really nice job of laying out a process for getting ideas across. Mm. So that'd be my number one. My number two would be You Play to Win the Game. Leadership Lessons for Success on and Off the Field. This was written by Herm Edwards, football coach, many years ago. This is an old one. This one is so simple. Like it's a leadership book, but it's so common sense. It just sort of reiterates what it is to be a good leader. And I crossed paths with this book very early on in my career. I was sort of thrust into a leadership position when I was at Citadel. We actually had the person that ran the group that I was in actually passed away unexpectedly. And following his passing, I moved into the head of the group. And I had this book on my desk. And Ken Griffin, I wasn't in the office at the time. I came back to my desk one day, and there was a note inside this book, a handwritten note from Ken Griffin that was basically saying, you know, you're the right person for this job. I know you can do a great job for it, in it, and, you know, lead your team well. Mm. And the simple principles in that Herm lays out are, you know, I think they're basic, but they're fundamental.
Are there any one, two, or three that come to mind?
There's one that comes to mind every single time, and it is that you don't have to treat everyone the same, but you do have to treat everyone fairly. Mm. And I think that's a really, like I said, it's just a fundamental. It's funny in business. I run into this all the time where, you know, I'll be talking with a manager who's like, no, we can't do this for this person because we didn't do it for that person. And we don't want to do it for everyone. And you really have to stop and think for a minute for something as simple as, I'm just trying to think of an example, something as simple as somebody on your team who needs to come into the office more, doesn't want to work virtually, wants to come into the office, but your office, and you actually have an office, your office has you have to pay to park, right? So that's a barrier for this individual, right? It's mm-hmm. like, well, I come into the office, but I really don't want to spend $15 every time I come into the office to park.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's think that through from a management perspective. It's $15 a day. Is that really an issue? Well, you know, we don't reimburse everybody's parking. We've got employees in New York. I don't reimburse their parking, right? Well, you know, maybe things mean different things to different people, right? Like half our employees in New York don't have cars.
Yeah.
Right. So should we maybe think about reimbursing the employee who has a real reason to get into the office versus rolling out a whole program where now we have to pay for everyone's parking, right? Yeah. So that's a stupid example, but I think it's a good example where you want to diagnose each individual on your team, the things that matter to them. And as a leader, you want to make sure that they've got the tools that they need and they're not all the same.
Yeah, I think leadership teams are facing the opposite problem right now, though. It's, I don't want to come into the office.
That's true. It's true. That's a good point.
Yeah. What's the third book?
So the third one is actually by Dan Harris, who was formerly an ABC News anchor, Good Morning America and Nightline. He wrote a book, it's probably more than 5 years ago now, maybe 10 years ago, 10% Happier, How I Tamed the Voice in My Head, Reduced Stress Without Losing My Edge, and Found Self-Help That Actually Works.
I've read this as well.
Yeah, that's... Yeah. That one actually changed the world for me, especially as an entrepreneur, because... Yeah, I'm sure you've experienced this as well. There are a lot of very stressful moments. as you're building things out. And sometimes your worst enemy can be right inside your own head.
Yeah.
And I think hearing Dan's story of how he experienced, you know, I think it was the war in Iraq that he covered, or Afghanistan, and then coming back, and then his story of, you know, just in the television industry. And I was at the Weather Channel, right? So I have a fascination with the TV industry generally. Right. But then just kind of listening to the ways he was really challenged. And then he also did a full journalistic exposition of meditation and the various mindfulness techniques, which ones are sort of really too far out there, which ones sort of work for real people. And then he started a company out of it. So I've also been really interested in their entrepreneurial journey.
What's his company?
10% Happier.
Okay. I didn't realize that. And I gather that you now meditate.
I do. Yeah. I've done pretty much at least five days a week. I aspire to 6 or 7, but sometimes not on the weekends. Yeah.
Well, that's okay. We can't all be perfect, can we? So who are or what are three founders and or startups that you love and you want everybody else to know about?
The one that people will know is Basecamp. Yeah, I love that story. I love the principles, like the 37 signals, the basic principles of that company. And I think there's been some recent controversy around this whole thing that I'm just kind of going to pass over for a second, because I think the fundamentals there, and I think that story, are just really solid. And it's contrary to a lot of what you hear as you start to come into founding your own business. And especially if you're in the Bay Area or in California, right? Like I think the Basecamp approach is just super interesting. So that would be the first one. The others are people may not have heard of, but they can go look up. So I had the great joy and opportunity of working with a gentleman named Steve Lekas at a previous job. It was sort of actually so I started the company out of UCSD. We merged with another company. During that whole process, things got really thin for a period of time. Before the merger, things got really thin. And the company that I had started needed to keep running. And I could do other things, right? So I needed to keep the capital in the business. I could go make money somewhere else. So I took another job where I got a chance to work with Steve in a leadership training program, of all things. Steve and I both worked for this company. The name of the company was Verisk Analytics. It was a big public company. I was doing climate, he was doing insurance. And following, we both wound up leaving Verisk. I wound up going back to the company that I had started. He wound up starting Branch Insurance, which is I think they've got a great story of really doing, I mean, insurance is a pretty boring industry, but Branch is doing new and novel things. And I think Steve's story of basically growing it, he started the company not that long ago. It was more than a year ago. It was probably closer to 5 years ago, but it's really been pretty recent and has taken it from seed through Series B. I think they just raised $130 million with $1 billion valuation. And they have a great, I mean, look them up, Branch Insurance. They've got a really nice sort of community approach. So I think there's a lot of values there. And then the last one that I'll say is actually the guy that founded the weather app company that I mentioned before, the one that had the real-time storm tracking that was used by President Obama.
Yeah.
Matt Winsing is his name. He started the company with Storm Pulse at the time when he started it. When we merged, we became Risk Pulse. And I had an opportunity to work with Matt for 3 or 4 years. I thought I knew what it was to be a founder because I had started the company out of the university. Matt really taught me what it means to be a founder. Like his creativity, his just vision and stick-to-itiveness with a vision. Today, he runs a company called Summit, and he has a podcast as well. Out of Beta is the name of his podcast. Yeah, I just think his journey has been one that I really admire. So that'd be the last one.
Awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate you being here and talking all things weather, because it's so important, whether or not you think it is. And I'm sorry. I'm sure there are so many weather puns, which I'd like to do with you.
I'm going to finish the bourbon now.
Yeah, wait, hold on. Do you have a good weather pun, which you'd like to share?
No, I don't.
No.
I'm not a punny guy.
Great. Well, are there any final thoughts that you'd like to leave listeners with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the where I'd like to leave it is just, like I said, we don't care about the weather. We care about what the weather makes us do. Those of us who are in business of any sort, you can think about the weather's impact to that business in three phases. So the first is understanding how your business reacts to the weather in whatever way. So go to the very basic lemonade stand. When it is hot and sunny outside, you sell a lot of lemonade. So quantifying that early on. Okay, so how many hot sunny days are there in my neighborhood every year? You know, how should I think about having inventory on hand? Mm-hmm. So that's step two, is actually beginning to plan around what you know about that quantification of what the weather does for your business. It's building the scenarios, the contingency plans for when it gets, when there is a 5-day forecast, when my TV meteorologist tells me it's going to be 105 degrees on Friday, I go buy lemons. I go buy sugar. You know, I make sure I've got all the cups. Mm-hmm. So it's developing those contingency plans and which tools that you need to implement them. So in that case, you just need a TV. You just need to watch and see when the weather forecaster says it's going to be 105 degrees, right? Mm. So that's step two. Step three is bringing in the accessing the devices that help you recover following a weather event that is bad for your business. Mm. We can't control it. The bad thing's going to happen. We're gonna lose money on that cold, snowy day where you can't sell lemonade, or that cold, rainy day where you can't sell lemonade. So, you know, I see a world where in those instances, you have something that looks like insurance that helps pay you for the lemons and the sugar that you didn't get to use. Mm-hmm. So that three-step process is, you know, I think every business can already do that today. Mm-hmm. All the technology is there. The companies are there to help, you know, build that resilience. And that's really how I see climate resilience is in that three-step process.
Mm, absolutely. And you know what? You could probably start another business where it's advising people on wherever they're located, the like three or five things they should have in their house, depending on what might happen with the weather when it becomes extreme. Like in the Bay Area, have at least one or two good bottles of wine, right?
Maybe a couple hundred if you've got the right cellar, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I greatly appreciate it. And I can't wait to share this with everybody and to meet you in real life in North Carolina in the not too distant future.
Yeah, please let me know when you're going to be here. Even when you're here for fun, if you want to swing by to see a cellar that's got some wine in it too and it's got some good ones, I'd be happy to share.
Okay, I'll take you up on it.
Yeah.
Well, hey, thank you so much and have a great evening.
Matt, this has been fun. Thanks.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for listening. The resources that we mentioned and everything else we talked about, drink recipes, various people, companies, so on and so forth, will all be linked in the show notes on our Substack at climatetechcocktails.substack.com. If you want to write us, our email address is m@climatetechcocktails.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at @CT_cocktails and on Instagram, #ClimateTechCocktails. You can reach me personally by carrier pigeon or on my LinkedIn /Matthew J. Myers. Until next time, keep the dream alive and do your part to make the world a better place for 100% of humanity. And thanks for tuning in.